Welcome to Crosstalk, the greatest podcast to find out how people stay sober and are happy. That's the thing about this thing is you don't have to finish your life when you stop finishing your days of drinking and drugging. This is how you find out how to stay sober, be happy and have a good life. And it doesn't start when you do drugs, doesn't stop when you stop doing drugs. It starts when you stop, when you're starting and stopping. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I just got a little lost there. It doesn't end when you stop doing drugs. It starts. And we're going to find out a little bit about that today from a terrific guest. Before we start, I want you to subscribe. Please subscribe, like us, and ring that bell. Let us know what you think. Give us some comments. Tell us what we're doing that you like. Tell us what you want to see more of, and we'll do it. Okay, and we'll get, without any further ado, my good friend Craig Robinson is here. And Craig, welcome to Crosstalk.
It's great to be with you. I have not subscribed. I think I need to subscribe, probably.
Well, if you haven't subscribed, this whole thing is over. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We're here on a Sunday morning in sunny, not so sunny Florida today.
No, but beautiful view out there.
Wonderful view. Yeah. The best thing is that I get to spend an hour or so with you, and we just go back and forth. Crosstalk is named because you're not allowed to do that at certain places.
I figured. I had a feeling that it had something to do with that.
That's all we do.
Yeah, perfect.
So let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
Where'd you grow up and what was that like?
So I grew up outside of Philadelphia. I had a pretty normal upbringing. I know that people talk about, having alcohol and addiction running in the family. That was not the case for me. Both of my parents did not really use alcohol that much. I had a brother who really did not use it all that much as well. Great family. My dad was an engineer. My mom was a special education teacher and then became a learning consultant. So I had great role models growing up and an older brother who's also an attorney now.
How much older than
he's
you?
He's 3 years older than me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He lives up in North Jersey.
So everybody's educated.
Everybody is educated. Although my dad was the first one in his family, I believe, to get a college degree. And he always these days would ask, raising two lawyers, what he did wrong. So you could probably appreciate right. that.
You're not a recovering lawyer.
No, I'm still a lawyer. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. People talk about that.
Yeah, 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 for sure, for sure. So normal upbringing, played sports and did good in school and, was just pretty happy kid.
What sports did you play?
Basketball was my main one.
Mm-hmm. Did that have anything to do with your height?
It did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm 6'4", so.
When did you start playing basketball? From the early?
When I was probably, I want to say 4 or 5 years old. You know, my memories of those times are a little bit foggy, but I'd say it was probably about then.
Right. I'm jealous because I loved basketball.
Yeah.
And my career ended at seventh grade when I went from being the tallest guy to the shortest guy.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, I went from being a shorter guy. I mean, I always, they knew I was going to be tall. My feet were ginormous. I think from about age 10 on, I was a size 10 shoe, and then it grew every year with my age until I was 15, and then I was a 15.
You know what they say, big shoes, big boots.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
Is that all they say?
I actually stole that from Pee Wee Herman.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I knew we were going to have fun here, and that was why I was so excited about coming here too. So
you played basketball on the high school team?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you a star or were you forward? Or?
I was about. I was all league. I was a center actually, at 6'4". So I was one of the tallest guys on my team.
Right.
That was my true love as far as sports.
Now, in high school, were you a party boy?
Yes.
When did that start?
So that started probably my sophomore year of high school. People remember their first drink. I have to be honest, I don't really remember my first drink. I just remember loving to drink. Experimented with drugs in high school.
Pot?
Pot, mushrooms.
Oh.
ecstasy.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Ecstasy. In high school.
Yes. Yeah. No cocaine yet at that point, but that didn't, you know, came a little bit after that.
Was coke your drug of choice? Is that why you say it that way?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, coke was, I mean, I did coke for the first time at 18 and that I'll never forget the first time I did coke. Because that was, I felt like I had discovered the answer.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What did it do for you?
It felt like it was a performance enhancing drug for me. It felt like it took, I mean, I was always social, but it took my ability to be social to a whole new level. In work and in school, I felt like it gave me a kind of a competitive edge.
So 18, you were in college.
Yes.
So college was coke.
Yep. Yep. Spring break was the first time I did it in Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fond memories. So is there a euphoric recall when you think of them?
There is. Yeah. I mean, you know, look, I mean, I hear people say my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk.
Right. So freshman year in college, you discover coke.
Yeah.
It's your drug of choice. Yep. And the fuse is lit.
Yeah, the fuse is lit. I was in a fraternity in college. I went to Penn State, lived with 60 guys who were all animals. It's just the
partying. Everybody's partying.
Yeah, everybody's partying. And so, yeah, a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol. And the thing of it was, it didn't really affect me in school. I mean, could I have done better? Maybe without it. But if anything, I thought that it might even be helping me. You know, to get through like test taking long days.
How were you able to afford doing coke all the time?
That's a great question. I mean, I was supported by my parents through college. So, you know, and I don't remember it being as expensive in college. I went to Penn State, so it's state college. So I don't know if there was like inflation when I got to Philly, you know, on it, but or a tax of sorts. But
right.
But, you know, and also I have to say at that point, it was more every weekend than during the week and every day.
Which explains you getting through the classes and getting grades.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. It'd be funny if you said, how did you pay for coke? School loans.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I have to say in law school, school loans were, that's when school loans came into play. So right. I'm sure that helped a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
So you get through college, you graduate.
Yep.
With honors?
No.
Okay.
3.4 GPA.
Okay. I would have given you honors for that.
Was that honors?
That was honors.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, I was a business major, not to, you know, it's my brother went to school at Penn State also. We overlapped for about a year and he was a chemical engineering major. So he actually really did real work.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
And he became a lawyer.
He did.
Chemical engineering major becomes a lawyer.
He's a pharmaceutical patent attorney.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he's really smart.
He is really smart. A whole new level of smart.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you, what made you want to go to law school?
I had been talking about law school since I was in the third grade. I'd always wanted to be a lawyer. And when I was in my freshman year of college, I got an opportunity to intern in Philadelphia for a trial attorney. And so I basically, my internship was just following him wherever he went. It was the greatest internship ever. I didn't really have to do a lot of real work, but I got to go to court all the time. The gym, you know, eating out at nice restaurants. I mean, the life looked very attractive.
Right. And that's what he was doing. So you were just shadowing him.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he hired me out of law school, actually.
And was it litigation?
It was. Yeah. Yeah. And then he fired me. We could get into that.
Why would he do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's when things started to really ramp up.
How old are you at this time?
I am 2012. So I am about 30.
So you're working with him as an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you have your own caseload.
Yep.
You're doing litigation.
Yeah.
What are you doing in terms of drugs and alcohol?
So at that point, my first year out of law school, I did well in law school too, by the way. I mean, it did not affect me. I went to Villanova. I was the graduating speaker of my class at Villanova.
Wow.
Yeah.
They didn't have anybody else who spoke English?
That was it. Yeah. Well, I have to say It was a vote. It was not based on on grace.
So they loved you.
They did. I guess so.
This is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But I remember coming. I remember speaking at that, and I had just gotten back from Vegas the day before, which was pretty common at that point in time. And I had no voice. I'd gotten back and I had lost my voice. So I remember, like, for 24 hours just trying to get my voice back from whatever I had done to abuse my body in Vegas. But so that was pretty common. I mean, even trying cases was like, I felt like I was always kind of trying to recover from.
It's hard. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to keep up with your what you want to do, extracurricular stuff, and try to function. I identify with that as a fellow attorney.
Yeah.
My first year in practice, which is when I got sober in 82, I took a little sidestep about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But when I got sober, I just couldn't, I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I couldn't manage the responsibilities. And so I had a choice. I could either stop practicing law or stop doing drugs. And it seemed like the better choice might've been to stop partying.
Not everybody would make that choice, but that's,
it's good that we did.
Yeah. 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 Cause I mean, I remember, I mean, you know, to that point, my first year in practicing, I remember I had a day where I was, you know, going to meet with a bunch of clients that day. And I just remember feeling like I was hungover from the night before. And it was the first time I used, I think, if I remember correctly, during a work day. And I felt like, you know, that performance enhancing feeling that I talked about, like it helped me get me through my day. And that was cocaine, you know, and so, and for a while, I really firmly believe that it did make me better at my job.
In retrospect, do you still think that?
No, I mean, well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, I think that obviously once you hear about where it took me, because it's a progressive disease, and the more you continue to use it, at least in my experience, the more I kept using it, the more I could not stop. You know, and then you get to the point, and then I got to the point where, you know, I'm sitting in a courtroom, and that's all that I can think about is that. And that's kind of where the end of my, you know, journey with using, you know, ended. But
now
but,
you got fired at 30.
Yes.
And what did you do after that? Did you continue to use and still be a lawyer, or did you hook up with some other firm?
Yeah. It took me about 4 months to find a job. So I was unemployed for about 4 months. And I hooked up with another firm in Philadelphia. And I do have to just say at that, on that story, because that's actually a real big part of my story. Actually, the guy who fired me, he was someone I had known since I was about 10 years old. And he didn't know anything about what was going on with me as far as like my use. But he fired me really because of my actions that involved my use. Mm-hmm. He didn't know it at the time. But and I can get back to him kind of towards the end, but if you would have asked me at that point in time what role I played in that situation, I would have told you it was all him. You know, he was the problem. It had nothing to do with me. And in retrospect, getting to look back on it now, I was the problem. You know, I was firmly the problem. I've had the opportunity to make amends to him, you know, a long time after that. And that was pretty powerful. I can.
What's his first name?
Chuck.
Okay. We'll get back to Chuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. So you hook up with another firm.
Hook up with another firm, a firm called Lundy Law in Philadelphia, big personal injury firm. And I was with them for about 6.5 years. I did pretty well for probably the first 5 years of that. My use was still progressing, but I was able to kind of work through it. And, you know, but as with most people that are in addiction, it just, it got to the point where it was too much. I mean, I felt like there was a gravitational pull at all times that was telling me to use. And that's where it took me, to the point that I was unemployable, would be the best way I could describe myself.
physically, how did you, you know, what was the impact?
Yeah. Well, first of all, they say that people lose weight on cocaine. That was not my experience. In fact, there's a comedian, Artie Lang, who, you know, has been with the Howard Stern Show a bunch. And he, I remember seeing him doing a stand-up comedy routine, and he said, "I'm the only guy who got fat on cocaine." And I remember just thinking to myself, because I ballooned to probably 270 pounds.
Wow.
You know, at my heaviest. So physically, I was, actually my boss, that second boss, who I've had the opportunity to talk with, you know, now, he would just tell me, but that you're dragging ass. You look like you're dragging ass all the time. What's going on with you? You look like you haven't slept. And the reality was I hadn't.
So you were, what size suit were you at that point?
Oh man, I was a 48 extra long.
48 extra long.
Yeah. Might have even been, I might've had a 50 in there.
Whoa. And yeah. So the waist might've been 44.
Yeah. The waist was probably a 44. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was a big boy.
Wow. I could get two of those.
Yeah. Well, you know what would happen was I would go through this routine where I would use, and I probably wouldn't eat for like a day. And then my body would start to tell me, like, you need to eat. And then I would just eat everything in sight. You know, so that was kind of the cycle that I was in. So I think that was probably a factor in the weight gain.
Right. No, there could be a connection between the weight gain and eating everything in sight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a shot. I'd take it a shot with that.
Oh, it's good. It's great that we could laugh. You know, it is tragic, I think, but I think if you can't look back on it and find some humor in it, like, why are we even doing this? You know,
it actually enforces or reinforces
that
we're doing the right thing. 'Cause you look amazing today.
Thank you.
And we'll get into, thank you. We'll get into, you know, where you've gone from those days, but just taking you a little bit more slowly through it. So after 6.5 years with this firm, Lundy Law. They fire you.
No, they were probably going to fire me. And I, it was one of those like resigning before you get fired type of a deal. You know what's coming, so you do the right thing and just say.
Did you do it?
I'm going to politely excuse myself from this situation.
Did you do it politely or did you do it angry?
I have to tell you, no, I was not angry. I think that my boss at the time, not I think, but I think that he was really taken aback by the fact that I was leaving. Him and I had a really close relationship for a boss and an employee. And we still do today. I mean, he's somebody that when I was starting my own practice here that I was able to call and kind of ask advice to. And so he's a really special guy. And I think that he liked me. And I think he was confused as to why I was leaving. And I didn't really give him a really great answer.
Right.
I think I told him I had another opportunity, which was true in some respects. But, you know, that opportunity was really to just, you know, go into kind of isolation from the world.
So when you left the firm, did you connect with another firm or did you just start doing drugs a lot?
I knew that I could not work at that point.
So you're 50 extra, extra long.
50 extra, extra long.
And you're fat.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're unemployable.
Yep.
So everything is coming up roses at that point.
No, it was pretty terrible. It was pretty terrible.
What did that feel like?
Horrible, you know? And at that point I, you know, the suicidal thoughts started kind of coming in. If I can't work, I can't make money. I need a lot of money to support the habit that I have. And, I felt trapped, you know, like there was no way out. Like the walls were closing in on me and they literally were. I mean, my condo was in foreclosure at that point.
Wow.
In fact, when I got to treatment, it was about to be foreclosed upon.
And are we at the point where you go to treatment?
So I left the firm in February of 2018. And then I went to treatment in July of 2018. So for about 4 or 5 months, I was just kind of, for the most part, in my place in Philly, using around the clock, not looking for a job, telling people that I had a job.
No savings.
No. Well, I mean, very minimal.
Just using whatever you had to not pay your mortgage and
yep.
and do drugs.
I mean, I hadn't opened the mail in probably 6 months.
Hadn't opened the mail in 6 months.
Yep.
For a lawyer to not open the mail, can you imagine what that you can't even conceive of that now.
No.
I mean, the mail comes in, you open it up like...
I didn't even get it.
Really? Where did you have it deposited? Did you like send it
to...
It
was a condo building, so... it was in a mailbox. And truth be told, I have to tell you, I don't really even know whatever
happened
to it.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's somewhere, but
so when
I don't have to worry about it now, thank God, I don't think. But
right, probably not, yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I imagine you had a very vibrant dating life at this point.
No. The dating life was non-existent, you know. Yeah, there was no dating life for probably a good year and a half.
Right.
Towards the end, it was very different than prior to that. Took a long sabbatical. I wasn't very marketable, you know.
Right. Yeah, that tends to happen when. That's.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now what were the events that took you to treatment?
Yeah. So, the end of June, I had a suicide attempt in that apartment, and I, without getting the details aren't really that important, quite honestly. But it failed. And, shortly after that, I had, my brother needed help moving in Manhattan. And I had agreed to help him move. And after I had tried, I felt that if I was alone, I was going to try again. So I was kind of afraid of myself at this point. So I went up to New York. I remember getting on an Amtrak train at like 6 a.m. on the day that he moved. Went up and helped him move. And ended up going back to the Philadelphia area with my parents. And they... my dad drove me to, was driving me to a train station outside of Philadelphia to take the train back into my condo. And they really knew nothing at this point. I mean, I probably didn't look well, but as far as they knew, I was fine. I hadn't gone to them for money or for anything like that.
Might have an eating problem, but other than
that. I had
an
eating problem, yes.
Yeah.
I was 270. I was big. I mean,
but they didn't know why.
I had been big at times in my life. I kind of battled with weight, throughout my life. I'd get to a normal weight. I'd go back up, and it was kind of this constant fluctuation of being heavy and then being not heavy. but I remember, being in that car ride with my dad, and I felt like if I got on that train that I was going to die. Like this was the end. So this was my last opportunity to tell somebody what's really going on with me. And I remember just kind of like hyperventilating in that car. I started to kind of like, it was like a panic attack because I was like about to tell him what was going on with me, but I couldn't really get the words out. And he, God bless him, just like looked over at me and was like, what's going on, you know? And I could not speak. So he pulled over. We're in a parking lot, probably 3 minutes from the train station. And when I finally got a word out, the words were, I need help. I'm a cocaine addict. And he just looked at me and he said, well, let's go back to their house, to my parents' house, and we'll figure this out. We knew of Karen from a family friend, and so that was the first call that we made together. So that was the beginning of the journey in recovery.
That's a really nice reaction.
Yeah.
That your dad had, because there's all kinds of reactions.
Yeah.
that a parent can have when, you know, there some of the more narcissistic humans on the earth
would
wonder how that impacts them.
Right.
Some would get angry.
Yeah.
Others would like, you know, you're not my son anymore.
Yeah.
This was a loving, wonderful, how can I help you response.
Yeah, it was. And I have to say with my dad, I guess I didn't really know how he would react. He's a very calm and easygoing man. But I was more worried about what society might think of it. By society, I mean the Pennsylvania bar, would I be able to be a lawyer again? If I disclose what was really going on with me, you know, they have these organizations that help lawyers
concerned for lawyers.
Yeah. And they say, you know, they're confidential and whatnot, but
they are,
I know they are now.
Yeah.
But at the time the thoughts in my head were, if I really tell them the truth, how is this going to go for me? You know, so I was afraid.
That's one of the reasons why lawyers don't ask for help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three times the number of the civilians, as we'll call them for this conversation, were three times as likely to be impacted by substance use disorder than the rest of the world.
Right.
And we don't get help specifically for that reason, because if anybody knew, we may never be able to be a lawyer again.
Right, right. Little did I know, that's not the case.
Oh boy, this is going to be the banner advertisement for why that's not the case.
Yeah.
This podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
Because I know what's coming later.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's really important for lawyers, or really for anyone to know out there. I mean, but lawyers in particular, from my experience, that if you're thinking that, that I'm going to lose my law license because I'm going to admit to using drugs, that's not the case. I mean, I told the Florida bar everything about me, and they still let me practice law here.
Right. Well, and the reason they did is that you were transparent.
Yeah.
And transparency is transformative.
Yeah.
And in your case, as we'll find out in a little while, it really life-changing. Yeah. So your dad calls Karen and you decide that Karen's the right place.
Yeah, we didn't know anywhere else.
Karen,
I mean, thank God we didn't, because I believe it was the place that I needed at the time. But we had never been through this before. We had a kind of a cousin, a family friend, who had always talked about Karen, and he was like 10 years sober. And it was something that I had kind of tuned out when we would be at family get-togethers.
Well,
you know,
that's not what you wanted to hear.
No, no. So, but thank God that he did talk about it, because we knew who to call.
And did you go to Pennsylvania?
I did. Yeah.
So you went to Karen, Pennsylvania, which is in Wernersville, Pennsylvania.
Correct. Yep.
And how long did you spend there?
Just under 30 days, like 28 days.
And was that were you a willing participant, or did you kick and scream?
No, I was willing. I had the gift of desperation. I mean, I didn't really have anywhere to go, you know, at that point. I mean, like I said, there was...
You were ready to give up.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know what that meant at the time. And I thought that cocaine was my real problem at that point. I didn't think that alcohol really played a role. So with some self-discovery and
education,
I learned that alcohol was actually really the root of the problem. I mean, I was the root of the problem, but alcohol always led me to cocaine. So if I had a drink, my mind would immediately take me to cocaine every time.
But the operative word here is surrender.
Surrender. It is. Yeah.
So you were ready.
I was ready.
And you spent 30 days there.
Yep.
Any particular recollections about those 30 days?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot.
Throw them at me.
Neil.
Who?
Neil DeVito. Who you had on your podcast. You never heard of him.
Neil DeVito. Oh, the guy with the shiny head.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, Neil. I walked into my first group, and Neil is wearing flamingo, like, shorts with these big pink flamingos on them. And I took one look at this guy, like, is this really, like, who I'm going to be in treatment with? this big smile on his face. Like, you've never seen somebody smiling this much in treatment. He could not have been happier to be where he was. And I was pretty miserable at the time. And after that group, Neil came over and he just put his arm around me. And he's like, he literally just put his arm, he didn't know me. And he said, "You want me to show you around? I've been here before," which he had been there before.
Right.
And that started the real, a real friendship, brotherhood that we still have today. I could talk a little bit about that as well. But that guy, when we got down to Florida for treatment.
Hold on, you just went very quick.
Fair enough. Okay, I'll stay there. I'll stay there. But
there's a process to crosstalk. You can't just jump to Florida.
Well, I mean, I get excited when I talk about Neil, because if it hadn't been for Neil, I truly don't believe that I'd be here today. I don't know where I'd be, but I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't be living the life that I am today, because he pushed me into things that were uncomfortable for me. I didn't like AA or support groups or meetings, or I didn't like therapy very much. You know, Neil was like, he would push me kind of to do those things. And so I have him to thank in a lot of ways. I mean, he's funny as hell too. I mean, he's like, personality wise, I love hanging out with him, but really, I really firmly don't believe that I'd be here today if it wasn't for him.
Yeah. Well, he connected you.
Yeah.
And you connected with him.
He forced me to connect, and not just with him. He forced me to connect with other people like in recovery. He's amazing. I mean, the guy, and he still does it today for other people. But yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how much I love that guy.
So you meet Neil.
Yeah.
And they ship you both down to Florida?
They shipped him down first. He's down there. I don't even know I'm coming to Florida. And he calls me one day and he says, "Guess what?" He says, "I broke into the counselor's assistant office and I found the admission list for Florida and you're on it." I said, "Well, it's funny that you know that, because I don't even know that. No one's told me that I'm going to Florida." They hadn't had the talk with me yet. So Neil knew before I knew that I was coming to Florida. We had about a week and a half or so where he was down here and I was still up there.
Now, did your parents, were they involved in Karen, PA?
They came a couple times to Karen, PA. They came also to Florida, you know, when I made it down to Florida.
They were part of the effort to say, let's move down there.
They were part of the financial effort, definitely.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I was at this place where whatever they told me to do, I would do. Meaning the people at Karen. I developed this trust with my therapist and with the team there that I knew that these people knew what they were talking about, and I was just going to do whatever it was that they told me to do.
So you were going to clinical?
Clinical, yep. I had a woman named Josie as my therapist who changed my life. I tell her these days that she saved my life, which is probably true. I mean, she was exactly who I needed at that point in time in my life.
Josie has her own practice.
Yeah.
Her name is Josie Tynes, for any of you who don't know.
Yep.
And Josie was a guest on Crosstalk. And she's a rock star.
Yeah, rock star. She told me the hard truth, you know, that I needed to hear, you know. Things like, if you go back to Philadelphia, I give you 2 weeks before you're using cocaine again. So maybe you should stay here, you know. And she was right. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I have a feeling if I had gone back, things wouldn't have worked out as well as they did.
Well, we don't need to speculate.
Yeah. Well, is that an objection or?
Yeah. Sustained.
Yeah. But no, she's a good friend of ours, of my wife and I now. I talk to her still regularly. I don't do therapy with her anymore, but she's become a personal friend. And, you know, I would have done anything at that point that she advised me on. And she gave me some great advice, you know.
She's Phoenix, DeVita, Brad, all these people that you had contact with.
Yeah.
How many lives each of them have saved cumulatively? You could fill a very large stadium with that, I'm sure.
Yeah, there was some things in my condo in Philly that I needed kind of removed. And I was having difficulty finding someone who would help with that. And Phoenix did help me with that personally. Literally went to my condo in Philly. Who does that? You know? So when I see that guy, when I see Phoenix now, and I do see him pretty often, I get emotional every time I see him, because like I know what that man did for me and how he changed my life. I mean, you know, you can probably relate to this, but you get down here and all of a sudden all these people start coming into your life and it's like, how is this happening right now? Like, I mean, for me, it's a faith in God that I do believe that's the reason why all this has happened. But the fact that all of these incredible people have come into my life at the same time, my wife included, we can talk about her a little bit as well. But it was like unbelievable. Like how, I don't even know how this all came together.
So for people listening who are wondering how the hell you do this, how you transition from being an active user, what's your size right now? What suit size are you?
42.
So what are the lessons that you learned, if you could kind of summarize a little bit of what are the nuggets of wisdom? What are can you crystallize a little bit of the things that you learned that changed from the way you were doing things to the way you do things now?
Yeah. The first thing I would say is asking for help. You know, what I did with my dad in that car and asked for help was one of the first times in a long time that I had actually asked for help in my personal life. So, and the reason why I hadn't for so long was because I thought I knew best. I thought that I had always been able to kind of maneuver my way out of situations, whether it be practicing law while under the circumstances that I was under. It's like I always found a way to get out of things or to figure them out. But when I got down here, I met a guy named Jimmy. And Jimmy is sober for 41 years now. He never made it through high school. And what he told me was, one of the first things he told me was, your way sucks. You asked me what my quote was, and I said, it's truth is hate to those who hate the truth. And that is something personal to me because I hated the truth. The first time I heard the truth, this guy that doesn't have a high school degree is going to tell me that my way sucks, you know? But that was true. The way I had been doing things for so long sucked. Because I thought that I was in charge and that no matter what, I could figure them out. And, you know, he told me that, you're going to have to form a relationship with this thing called God. And, it's not that I didn't believe in God, but I never really had a relationship with God. I grew up Jewish, went to synagogue on the high holidays and asked for all the material things in the world and for all these great things to happen in my life. But did I ever really think about other people? Did I ever really think about anyone other than myself? Did I ever think that maybe there was something greater than me that was controlling the outcomes in my life? And did I ever ask that power to relieve me of the bondage of self, to take away this desire to use cocaine and to fill my body with drugs and alcohol? Like, I never really thought of it that way. And so when Jimmy started kind of describing this to me of what I needed to do, and the thing about him was that this man had a peace about him that I had never really seen in another human being. No matter what happened to him, he was never rattled, and he had a blast. Like, this guy walked around with this giant smile on his face, and you could tell it was real. And of all the things that I wanted in life, that was the thing that I wanted most, was to be able to just have peace of mind. Like, that was the thing I had been chasing for so long. My mind was so riddled with all these bad thoughts and, you know, and it was like a constant hamster wheel. And I wanted out of that. And I didn't know there was a way out of that. But I started hanging out with this guy hanging out with Neil, hanging out with other people who had a lot of time in recovery, Big John. Big John told me that I needed to go to these, you know, meetings, like, you know, on the regular. And I would lie and I would say that I had other things to do, that I had yoga at Ocean Drive, or I had to play basketball, or I had a meeting. And he just really like pushed me and said, "You're full of shit. You are so full of shit. Like, you need to make your recovery the most important thing in your life. And if you don't do that, you're going to lose anything that you've gained. Like, if you don't make this recovery thing the most important thing, you will lose everything that you have." I didn't really have much at the time, but he said, "As this process goes along, you will lose everything you have if your recovery doesn't come first." And I believed him. You know, I didn't know what it took at that point to get sober and stay sober, but I did come to believe that my way does suck. And what that means to me is just that I'm not in the results business. I can't control the outcomes of my life. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow to me. I don't know if I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I do know that if I put my recovery first today and I put my recovery first tomorrow, then my chances of drinking and using drugs go down significantly. And so I need to reinforce that. I need to actually have a relationship with God. And I hate to make this all about God, because, and if you would have told me 6 years ago that I'd be sitting here talking about how big of a role God has played in my life, I would have told you were out of your mind. But my faith has been kind of the guiding light throughout this whole journey. And that's really what's brought all these incredible people like yourself too. I mean, you know, I look up to you in a lot of ways. I really do. Everything that you're doing with this too. I mean, you meet such incredible people that are doing incredible things to help others. Like, why are you doing this? I know why you're doing this. You're interviewing me so that you can help spread the message of recovery to others. It's incredible.
What you described is asking for help and connecting with other people. Mm-hmm. What was it? I think it was Randall that I first heard say that connection is the opposite of active addiction.
Yeah.
Connecting with the people that you did the spiritual part of the process is really important.
Yeah.
Some of the gifts that have come into your life are pretty meaningful. Before we get to your personal life,
yeah.
I remember there was a time when we first met each other, which is about 6 years ago, that you were struggling, or I should say you were in the process of trying to navigate your way through getting admitted to practice law in Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, talk a little bit about that.
Sure, sure. So, so I will also just say, so I'm in Josie's office one day. This is kind of the beginning of that. And I'm trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. And she brings up the idea of taking the Florida bar. And I said, "I just don't think I want to do that." And then she said, "Well, you should go back to school for a master's of social work," which I did, actually. An incredible experience to do that too. But with the bar, she brought this guy Richard in. She said, "There's this guy Richard that works here who's kind of been through this. And he doesn't meet with patients, but I'm going to introduce you to him. He's my law partner now." But he kind of guided me through this process with the Florida bar. And when you're applying for the bar and you've been to treatment, at that point you had to disclose it to the Florida bar. And once you disclose that you've been to treatment, it opens you up to a character and fitness investigation. So I had passed the bar in Florida, and for about a year and a half, I was undergoing this investigation by the Florida bar. They overturned every stone in my life. And I was 35 at the time, but I'd been through some stuff, you know, personal lawsuits. And I didn't mention that, but when I got fired, there were lawsuits that came out of that with Chuck. And that's important to the end story too, because Chuck actually, even after all of that, I mean, we sued each other.
Chuck was the attorney you first worked for.
Yeah, that fired me. And things got really ugly with us. I didn't talk in a lot of detail, but I mean, we were suing each other for a few years. It was covered in the Philadelphia legal newspapers and whatnot. He ended up writing me a letter of recommendation to the Florida bar, you know, after I made amends to him. But one of the things, that just to give you an example of some of the things that they overturned, I mean, they pulled my law school application in at Villanova, and they found an inconsistency. So this was 15 years ago from the time I was applying. And they found that I had not disclosed an underage drinking citation that I had received on my law school application. So they made me write a letter to Villanova Law School, formally amending my application 15 years after I went there. And I got a letter back from Villanova saying, thank you, we've updated your file and you know, best of luck. But at the time, I found it really annoying to have to go through all this. And I was thinking to myself, why am I going through this right now? Why are they doing this to me? I never got arrested. I never lost my law license in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. They made me write a 30-page legal brief on candor towards the tribunal. Honesty, for those that, you know, really was the topic of that brief, and it was very annoying at the time. In hindsight, going through that helped me to clear up all of the crap in my life that needed to be cleared up. So when it was all done, it felt like a weight had been lifted off of my shoulders.
It was like a legal fourth step.
It was. The whole thing was a fourth, you know, and then there was a fifth step because I had to have a hearing in front of the Florida Board of Bar Examiners for about an hour and a half, where they questioned me about, like, how do we know that the guy that you are today, which we see that you're doing really, really well, but how do we know that that guy is going to be the guy that's always going to be practicing law here, you know, in Florida? Those were the kinds of questions that they made me answer.
What was your answer to that?
Well, I had prepped for this, obviously. I had an attorney. But,
when you say this, you don't mean for crosstalk.
No, for the hearing, no. I did prep for this, yeah. No, I didn't prep for this, but that hearing, you know, I said to them, I can't really guarantee anything. I mean, for me to sit here and tell you, I'm going to guarantee you what's going to happen in the future, I can't make that guarantee. I don't think any person or lawyer can, but what I can tell you is that I really, really, really do not want to go back to that life I was living, you know, and I want to do everything in my power, not just in my power, but I'm going to take whatever actions I need to take to make sure that the lawyer and the person that you're getting is more than qualified to represent people in the state of Florida.
And, great answer.
Thank you.
I mean, that, you know where you got that answer from. You didn't get that answer from Villanova.
Right.
And you didn't get that from Lundy.
Yeah, that was the truth. That was the God's honest truth.
You got that from recovery.
Yeah. I also threw some quotes. They asked me, they said, well, how do you do with being around alcohol? And I said, well, any attempt to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. So I said, I'm going to be around alcohol. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she drinks, not alcoholically, thank God, but she can have a half a glass of wine and leave the rest on the table. Like, what even is that? How does that happen?
It's so annoying.
Yeah, it's very annoying. And it also feels like a waste to some degree. But, you know, but yeah, I mean, I told them I'm going to be around alcohol. I just am. It's the world we live in. And for people that don't have a problem with it, it serves a purpose, you know. But for me, I can't do that. I know what happens if I take a drink. You know, that tape does not end well.
Good.
Yeah.
So you go through the process?
I go through the process. They give me a conditional admission, which is an admission that requires me to go to meetings once a week. You know, it was like no big deal. I actually liked going to them, so it wasn't a problem for me at that point.
Now, the meetings you're talking about are 12-step meetings?
They were not 12-step meetings. They were something called FLA, Florida Lawyers Assistance.
Okay, so different kind of meetings.
Yeah. Similar. You just kind of get in a room and talk about what's going on in your life. And
right. But they were designated meetings, not just leaving you on your own to go to, you know, like transcendental medication meetings.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So there was that drug testing. I had an app on my phone. you know, every morning I would check the app. If I got pinged for a drug test, I'd have to go, you know, do a drug test. There were 8 a year. Wasn't a big deal.
How many years did that go on for?
3.5.
Over now?
Yeah. From the start, from the first day of my recovery. So they retroactively made it. So it was about 1.5 years
right.
from the time I got okay. admitted. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm off that now.
Are you still an admitted attorney in the state of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, and New Jersey.
Very good.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the interesting thing about Pennsylvania, New Jersey is I didn't have to report really anything to them. I never got in trouble. Thankfully, I quit before things got to the point where I really
right.
Messed anything up. I have to say, like, I did well on the legal cases that I represented clients in.
So somewhere along, aside from meeting your boyfriend,
yeah,
Neil.
That's what my wife calls him, too.
Right. So who's this? What happened? When did you meet a wife?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
So while I'm at Ocean Drive, so we're going back a little bit, Ocean Drive had a deal with Lifetime with the gym. And so they would take us there for personal training sessions. And so my wife was my personal trainer while I was in treatment. So she, we were not flirtating. I have to tell you, I was like, I mean, you know, because I just told you everything, but I didn't have money. I didn't really have anything going for me at the time. And when I started training with my wife, I started telling her everything. I mean, she didn't work for the treatment facility, but I just started sharing everything about me with her. And if you would have heard these things, the fact that anyone could be remotely attracted to the person that was telling them to her. But it wasn't like instantly, like we started dating right away. She was going through a divorce actually at the time. And so for about 3 months, we were just training with each other. There was no flirtation or anything there. And then when I got to IOP,
IOP is intensive outpatient.
Intensive outpatient. Yeah. So I had some freedom at that point in time. I was still going to the gym. I think they gave you a half hour per week and I quickly upped that to like 3 hours per week. So I wasn't interested in her at all. But she helped me lose a lot of weight. I have to tell you, I got down to, 240, which was the lowest that I had been in a long time. I went back up at one point in time and then came back down. But we on paper, we were a terrible idea. Randall, who you mentioned, I went to him at one point and I said, I'm really interested in this girl, but I also know that my recovery has to come first. I need to get into the Florida bar. I want to go back to school. I want to start a business. How does a new relationship fit into all this? And Randall looked at me and he said, man, he's like, just tell her that. Just like you just said it, like I have all these things in my life that I need to accomplish and recovery comes first. So you can't be my top priority right now. And that's literally what I said to her. Probably sounds harsh today, but she understood it. You know, she knew that like I had to go to meetings. I had to go to stuff to get back into the Florida bar. I was not going to be able to give her my full attention at that point in time. But she said, that's fine. You know, she loved the idea of recovery. She has some family members who, one in particular, her mom now who's in recovery, but recovery was something very important to her family because addiction ran through her family.
Did she ever go to Al-Anon?
She did, yeah, yeah. Not now. She never really had to go for me.
Right,
You know, thankfully she's never seen me drunk, you know, right. or high.
By the way, I'm not going to do it right now, but I can do a good Randall imitation.
Oh, too. You can. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'd love to hear that. But he helped me a ton.
He's great
with that. Because he let me know that it was okay to still be in a relationship with her, but also have her know that like, I've got to put these other things before this. We actually got engaged at Karen.
Really?
Yeah. So what happened was I...
What did you like? You came right out of a therapy session and say, excuse me. and you made believe you had to go to the men's room. And
I was living at the I building and while I was an IRP. And I would sneak her into the I building. So
she didn't have a place to live.
She didn't at that point.
Really?
She had friends that
I was being funny.
No. She really, she had friends. She was like sleeping on a friend's couch at this point.
Oh, okay.
So, I invited her graciously into my treatment center.
You're a good guy.
Abode. Yeah. And when she gets there, she said, am I allowed to be here? And I said, yeah. I mean, you just got to, if you walk past somebody, just act like you belong here. They won't know. And then Phoenix one day saw me getting out of her car at clinical. She dropped me off. I didn't have a car down here. We were using her old beat up Volkswagen that kept breaking down everywhere we were. For Ocean Drive, I was like the poorest person that ever went to Ocean Drive at this point in time.
Right.
But it worked. It worked because she let me put my recovery first. You know, and that was the most attractive thing to me about her, was that like she actually believed that this was the most important thing, and she wasn't in recovery herself, and she's kept to that until today. If I tell her at any point, and we have a little one now, obviously, but if I tell her at any point,
Stella is two.
She'll be two in January. Yeah, but if I tell her at any point that I have to do something that's recovery related, the answer is go. You know,
that's because you teed it up that way at the beginning.
Yeah. She says to me, it's like I don't care if it's our anniversary, we'll celebrate another night. If you need to do something recovery related, just do it, you know? And so
you get engaged at Karen.
We get engaged at Karen. I proposed to her in the apartment that I used to sneak her into. I wasn't there at the time. I had a home at that point.
So she was alone when you proposed?
Yeah. Well, she was.
You weren't there.
Well,
you said you.
We weren't in that. We weren't living there anymore.
Oh, I see.
No, I was with her. I was with her. It is kind of like a blur a little bit. Because I had this whole plan to. I hired a guy who was a photographer, to pretend like he was a patient at Karen. And I told her that on the way to dinner, I had to drop off a big book to this guy. And then I told her, I said, he lives in the old apartment that we lived in. Why don't we just go see it? We hadn't seen it in a couple of years.
How romantic.
It is very romantic. Yeah. In fact, when I got down on one knee, her first words to me were, here? You're proposing to me here?
That's great.
But yeah. So
how long after that did you get married?
A year and 2 months.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a really wonderful story of, you know, how asking for help, where that can lead.
Yeah. We have a beautiful relationship. It's a healthy relationship, one in which we communicate with one another, which was a foreign concept to me, to like actually tell your partner how you're feeling and what's going on in your life and not hold things in and let resentments kind of come out. And so we have a pretty like calm, relaxed, normal home. It's wild. I mean, our daughter is kind of out of her mind in the best way possible. But we're always on the same page. I mean, I have to say, like, as every couple probably has arguments here and there, the arguments we have are like over what we're having for dinner that night. There's nothing that really rattles both of us very much.
And yeah. I assume now you're employed.
Yeah, gainfully.
Yeah, very good. That's good. So what do you do?
Yeah. So Richard and I talked about Richard, and we'd been friends for a few years, and I got licensed to practice law in 2020. I had opened my own practice, which was just me. And we started doing something called the Marchman Act. And the Marchman Act is a unique Florida law that allows for families or loved ones of someone who has issues with addiction or mental health to utilize the court to get them to go to treatment when they otherwise wouldn't go. So it helps families access treatment even when it feels out of reach for a loved one. So that is in 2021, September of 2021, we merged our practices into one and we started focusing on the Marchman Act and mental health guardianships, kind of similar, but a little bit different.
Now, did you get your social work degree before that?
Yeah. Yeah. I had my social work degree. I graduated, I should say I graduated in 2022. So there was about a year where I was still in the program.
So you have a master's of social work, you have a law degree. So it works really well with dealing with people who are you're struggling with addiction. And the Marchman Act, somebody has to be in the state of Florida.
Yes, physically, but they do not have to be from here. So we have a lot of families that find out about this from other states, and they strategize to bring their loved one here to take advantage of the law. So it's really pretty awesome work. The social work degree has helped me immensely in helping to understand things like family systems and the importance of how people grew up and who their parents are and who their family is and how much that affects who they are today. And we're representing the family. So sometimes the family needs just as much, if not more, help and, you know, guidance and resources as the person who's going to treatment themselves. So we get to provide that to them. And the social work degree has helped me with that. It's helped me to understand, you know, as you practice law, you know, you have clients who can be demanding at times and can, I'm trying to put this kind of politically correct, but they can be difficult.
I've never, yes. Yeah, it's tough. You're dealing with all kinds of people who come from all different places.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a mixed bag of crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You said that.
You can't say that.
But for me, it's and we constantly, we have a team now. We're 11 people, which is wild because this time last year it was pretty much just Richard and I. But what we tell our team all the time is, you know, compassion and empathy for the family and where they're at. Our team, for one reason or another, a lot of them are connected to recovery. This means something to them. And so, you know, don't ever forget what the family is going through. Don't ever forget what we put our families through when we were in the midst of our addiction. So when that person is calling 10 times in a row because they need an answer and they want to know what's going on right now, instead of saying, oh my God, I can't believe that person is calling me again, you know, pick up the phone and have that conversation with them, put their mind at ease. You may be the voice that gives them that peace of mind that they need in that moment. So it's really a concierge law firm and practice that we have. And we really try to stick by that compassion and empathy, honesty. You know, we try to live by the principles that we live by. You know, in our personal lives, in our work lives as well.
And I can't think of a better application of the skill set that you have than what you do. You have this wonderful gift that you were handed by people who we've talked about, all the names. These people all taught you and me how to behave, how to live, how to be happy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back to it's the Jimmy R's.
Yeah.
It's the Big John's.
Yeah.
And it's the clinical people that have gone through it themselves. And, you know, all we do is what they told us.
Yeah.
I always like to say that a lot of times I'll say things that are really smart.
Yeah.
None of it did I ever create
I don't believe that with you.
Well, you know, you make a very fair point.
No, but you're an exception.
But it's all no, cut it out.
I'm just gonna feed the beast right now. That's what I'm gonna do.
He's still humble, isn't he?
No, the truth is that everything that we do, we've gotten from somebody else. In a light most unfavorable to us, we steal it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a light most favorable, you know, it's a gift that we give away.
Yeah, and you know what it is? I need that just as much now, today, as I needed it on day one. Like, like, I need those reminders because I can get off the reservation pretty easily, right? So if I don't have Jimmy R in my life, if I don't have Neil in my life, if I don't have Big John in my life on a daily basis, I mean, I communicate with Jimmy R in some way, shape, or form every day. Either I see him, we have a phone call, and if it's really, really busy, we're text messaging. But some of the things that that guy still says to me to this day, I need to hear. If I don't hear them, my head can get off into that place that it was 6 years ago. So, and I love him. I love you. I love, like, all these people, you know, I have real relationships with them. Like, we care about one another. We would do anything for one another. Where else do you get that?
You know, it's a wonderful thing. You know, it's better late than never. You know, what we didn't get from the early years, we started our talk today, you know, with the early years, you know, mom and dad gives us everything that they have, but everything they have isn't everything that we need. Yeah. And we find it wherever we find it. We're lucky. You get to be able to stand up and be able to give it away.
Yeah.
And most importantly, live the way you just described. You know, he just looks happy.
It's real.
You know?
Yeah.
He just look happy.
Yeah, and it's real. And now I get to teach my daughter that.
Exactly.
She doesn't have to see her dad drunk. She doesn't have to see her dad high. I may not be a perfect person on a daily basis. But the one thing I want her to know is that, you know, is that I want to be the dad that she can come to me about anything. You know, that there won't be any judgment. You know, that I've been there. I've been through my own personal struggles with addiction, mental health. And I just want her to be able to talk to me. I don't want her to be afraid to talk to her dad about anything. You know, I mean, there's some things that she should probably talk to her mom about, but, you know, more women things, but I want her to feel like I'm there for her no matter what. And, so whatever it is that she's going through, I probably have been through some similar feelings in my life, you know, and I think that's probably the best thing a dad could do. I mean, my parents, there was a fear to be able to tell them what I was going through, but I don't blame them for that. In reality, the reaction they had was not the reaction I was expecting. So maybe it was all in my head, but they also didn't have issues with drugs and alcohol. So I didn't know to what degree they were going to understand or be able to wrap their heads around what I was going through.
Yeah. At the end of the day, they love us. And, you know, in the way it's supposed to work is how many times I've heard, you know, I didn't say that, I didn't speak up because I didn't think it would be received very well.
Yeah.
But, you know, most times, not all the time, but most times, you know, people that love us, you know, they want to know. They want to know who we are. They want to know what's going on with us. They want to know how they can help us.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's kind of selfish.
Yeah.
To not go to them.
Yeah, to not allow them to help us. Yeah. I mean,
my favorite thing that I've ever done in my life is be a dad to my two kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, and you know, the program, the 12-step program, talks about this phrase, and it applies to being a parent, mm-hmm. and many other things. It gets better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two is great.
I think we're going to, God willing, try to have a second. But I will just say this, you know, Corey, and I don't know if you had this experience, but, when I held my daughter for the first time, and, I looked at my wife, and she is usually the emotional one in the family. Well, not really. She's really not that, like, you know, she's not really like a huge crier, but I don't really cry all that often. And I was a mess in the hospital holding Stella, and Lex looked over at me. She's just like, what's going on with you right now? You know? And she loved it. She was like, you know, smiling. And I just said, you know, I guess at that point it was 5 years ago, four or five years ago, I didn't want to live anymore. You know, I wanted off this earth. And then 4 or 5 years later, I get to hold life in my hands that we created. And it's like, how, again, one of those, like, how does this happen? How did we get here? You know? And the reality is that I got here just by doing what people told me to do, taking suggestions, being open-minded, willing, surrendering, but listening to people that seemed like they knew better than I did. My way sucks. So maybe I should listen to some of these other people, you know, who seem to know a thing or two about this recovery deal. And that's like really all that I did. I still do that today, you know. But that's, I think that's the answer.
And you do that for everybody else too.
I try, you know, definitely try. That's what Jimmy always tells me. He said, we're not in the results business. We're in the trying business. So you have to try. You may try your ass off to help somebody and they may relapse, and that's okay. They helped you because, you know, you actually, you know, diving into that and really trying to help other people is what's going to keep you sober. So, you know, you can't control the outcome. I had like six guys that I was helping, the first six, I think, that relapsed. And I said to Jimmy, I'm like, these guys keep relapsing. Like, am I doing something wrong? Like, what's what's the deal? He's like, just keep doing what you're doing. Just keep trying. Keep picking up the phone. You can't expect the sick to reach out to the well. So reach out to them. You know, they may not reach out to you. So you reach out to them. Put your hand out. Introduce yourself. They might be scared shitless, just like you were on your first day. So you be the outgoing person with them. You know, it's all, like all these incredible things that I wouldn't know had it not been for guys like him.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how wonderful doing this with you has been. It's really been a gift for me. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. God bless. Appreciate
Thanks.
You, Corey.
Appreciate it. Thanks.